Thank you for joining me. I'm Julie Vecchio, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at Fisheries Pod, on Facebook and Instagram at Fisheries Podcast, or support the podcast on patreon.com/fisheriespodcast, along with Ben, Tyler, Janet, Robin, and John. If you're interested in showing off your support for the show, or even just a favorite fish species, please go to our merch store at teespring.com, where you can find t-shirts, hats, stickers, and more. Look for the link in the show description. This week, I'm talking to a fantastic fishery scientist and colleague, Dr. Dominique Lazar. Dominique is an associate research scientist with the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. She works with me in the Fisheries Dependent Monitoring Program. She's the lead data manager for all marine recreational fishery dependent data, providing data analysis to numerous state and federal agencies. Dominique got her bachelor's degree at Eckerd College, where she was a member of the Eckerd College Search and Rescue Team. She also has a PhD from the University of Miami, where she studied invasive lionfish in the Florida Keys. She has been involved with a wide variety of marine science teaching and outreach activities throughout her career, including teaching classes at Eckerd College and the University of South Florida, tutoring math and science, outdoor guiding in the Florida Keys, and serving as a resident scientist in a Miami middle school. Welcome to the podcast, Dominique. I really appreciate you sitting down with me today and taking an extra half hour of your time to figure out audio issues.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
So I usually like to start my interviews kind of by asking folks about their origin story in the environment or the ocean or that kind of thing. So what grabbed you about marine science or fisheries early on?
So I think my story is probably similar to a lot of other people. I was really lucky to have parents that got me out in nature as much as possible as a kid, definitely more my dad than my mom. My mom's more of a city girl, but my dad grew up in Haiti, always playing in the ocean, always out in nature. And when we were kids, he would take us out and about in nature a lot. And then also they were just pretty big on education. So we would do a lot of zoos and aquariums and museums and things like that for activities growing up. And I remember going to the Camden Aquarium as a little kid. I think it was elementary school or early middle school. And there was a dolphin show, even though dolphins aren't necessarily my favorite marine species now. But I remember just being really excited about it, going to the library and looking up what type of scientist worked with dolphins and thought, okay, marine biologist, that's what I'm going to be. When I got to college, I realized dolphins weren't something that I was super interested in. I was definitely more interested in fish. So I started moving away from kind of the dolphin, manatee, marine mammal aspects of marine science and more into fish and now fisheries.
So I always call dolphins the gateway animal because I feel like so many of us have like gotten our start in marine science with dolphins and just being like so enamored with dolphins. I had a really similar experience. We went to SeaWorld in Ohio when I was a kid, like 10, and I was just like amazed. And from that moment forward, I never did a project on anything but a marine mammal. I studied like every marine mammal.
It's so true. So many of the kids that I went to college with that started as a marine science major started saying, oh, I want to work with dolphins or I want to work with manatees. And then once we figured out that there was a world beyond the dolphins and the manatees, those of us who stuck it out, most of us have not continued down that track, but it was the same story for so many of us. So
your dad's from Haiti?
He is. He grew up in Jacmel until he was about 14 or 15.
Have you ever been there?
I did. I went when I was 4, I think, for a couple of months.
Oh, wow.
So I don't know if my memories are real memories or if they're, you know, like the stories that I put together in my head based on family talking about it and looking at pictures. We rode horses. My mom and dad said that there was a goat in the front yard in the house that we were staying at that we would chase around and we thought it was our pet goat. my dad let me know when we got back. I was asking him like, oh, how's our goat? How's our pet goat doing? He's like, oh, sweetie, we ate that before you left. So it was amazing. An interesting
It's amazing
time.
When you're four and you don't like pick up on that stuff.
Totally didn't realize it. My mom talks about getting like fresh fish and bread every day. So I think overall it was a pretty good trip for us then.
So you talked about attending Eckerd College, and I assume that was specifically due to their marine science program.
Yeah. So in middle school, when I decided, okay, I'm going to be a marine scientist, in my mind, I had to go to a school that had a marine science program. And around the same time that I was looking for colleges, my grandmother was moving from New Jersey to Florida, and my aunt and uncle had already, they already lived in Tampa at the time. So I was looking for colleges when my grandmother was house shopping, and my aunt and uncle said, oh, there's this school that's nearby us that does marine science. Do you want to go for a visit there while you're in town with your grandmother? And I said, sure. So of course I went to the Eckerd campus and fully fell in love. Just walking around the campus, it was during the summer, there weren't many people there, but it's a beautiful campus right on the water. They told me about all the fun things that I'd be able to do while I was a student there. So immediately said, okay, this is now my top choice. This is where I'm going to go to school. So I like that it was going to be a fairly small school. I like that it would have, or I could have, a marine science focus. And then also I knew that I'd have some family nearby. So all of those things checked all of my boxes, and Eckerd I knew was going to be my first choice after walking onto the campus.
I can barely even imagine being a college student there. I feel like I always say, you know, I grew up in the Midwest and had this like total marine focus throughout my, you know, throughout my whole life. But the thing that I always say about growing up where I did is that it was like a really good place to like get a really good education and like study a lot, because there was just like nothing else for me to do, because I was like so focused on marine things that like, I feel like if I'd gone to college at Eckerd, I like would have just flunked out just like being on the water all the time.
I mean, I definitely spent a ton of time on the water, but I also knew that it was, you know, like a sacrifice for my parents to help me get into school there. I was lucky that I had a full tuition scholarship, so it made it easier to stay. But I knew that I couldn't waste the opportunity. So as much as, you know, I could have fallen into the trap of just being out on the water and skipping class and things like that, I was pretty focused when I was in college, which helped, but it didn't mean that I didn't do a lot of fun things as well. So I spent a good portion of my time on the water. I learned a lot about boats while I was there. I learned how to sail. Developed a love of kayaking, just generally being on the water as much as humanly possible. So Eckerd definitely provides you with a lot of opportunities to do the fun things. And then hopefully you make the smart choices so that you can keep up with your studies as well. But it's definitely a struggle. I mean, the studying happened, but you know, it's sometimes nice to take your backpack out on the water with a kayak, beach it somewhere, and study out on a like near a mangrove island or on like a little spoil island. So you can mix those two genres sometimes, and Eckerd made it easier to do that.
While at Eckerd, you were also part of the Eckerd Search and Rescue. Can you tell me a little bit more about that program and what it takes to be a part of it?
Sure. So XR, Eckerd College Search and Rescue, was a huge part of, I guess, my development while I was at Eckerd. It was a ton of fun, but also a lot of work and a lot of responsibility. And I'd say that being a part of the team probably helped me keep that focus. So it allowed me to do fun things out on the water, but I also needed to make sure that, you know, like it's a fairly serious program. So the search and rescue team started or kind of developed from as the waterfront started to grow. They had sailboats, and in the early days of Eckerd, they wanted to make sure that they had the capabilities to help the Eckerd boats that were leaving the creek in case they got in trouble. So Bill Covert was the head of the waterfront and the person who developed the search and rescue team. He went to SAR school, learned a lot about maritime search and rescue, and then developed a program for Eckerd. So it's not just about going out on the water and rescuing people. It's also a student development program. So starting as a freshman, all the freshmen at Eckerd come during autumn term. So it's a 1 month term in August when it's mostly freshmen on campus. So that's when you're really starting to get adjusted to college life, but without the upperclassmen there to maybe make that transition a little bit more difficult. So there were these like early meetings saying, hey, do you want to get out on boats and help people in the bay? And as much as I like the water now, I didn't have a ton of exposure to boats growing up. So mostly like tubing down the Delaware River, going to the beach were the main access points for me. So I thought it was a way that I could learn more about boats because, you know, in my mind, I'm, you know, like fairly logical. If I wanted to be a marine biologist, I would have to learn about boats and feel comfortable on boats. You know, like I started learning how to tie knots and just found kind of my crew through the waterfront program. So various levels of training, you start out basically just as a crew on the boat where you learn how to tow boats and deal with a lot of different rescue techniques for different issues that you might find out in the bay. So people who run aground, people who run out of gas, people whose engines stop working. So there are a lot of different levels of training. So I did some specialty trainings so I could be essentially like a first responder on the team. So if there was a medical emergency, I might get called because I had some additional medical training. I was an equipment specialist, so I learned how to deal with all of our engines and pumps and things for dewatering vessels or for firefighting capabilities. And then as a junior and senior, you can be invited into boat driver training where you actually get to be the one who's captaining the boat when you go out on these different rescues. So, you know, essentially it's a free service to the people of Tampa Bay where anyone who gets themselves into trouble on the water can call essentially a hotline and we'll send a crew of highly trained college students out to help get you out of trouble. And I dealt with all manner of rescue during my time. And now, you know, almost 15 years post-graduation, it boggles my mind how many kind of crazy situations that I was put in as a student. Not that I wasn't like fully trained and capable of doing it, but when I think about people who are that age now, I'm like, oh God, how could they possibly? But you know, the staff really trained us well and made sure that we could handle ourselves and go out and do a really good job in the community. So it was a nice kind of community service thing to do. And then also just got me really comfortable being out on boats, which was nice.
I also have really enjoyed being on an all-female crew and having people just stare at us when we're at a boat ramp.
Oh yeah, that was always a fun one. I had many times encountering people in the bay and, you know, like the crews were generally fairly mixed in terms of gender. But there are definitely times when it would be like the all lady crew. So you'd pull up to boaters. Sometimes they were a little bit intoxicated, or sometimes they just didn't expect to see women who could handle themselves on a boat. So you'd get a lot of comments like, well, where's the man who's going to take care of this? And I'm like, well, this is a free service. If you want us to help you, I can, or I can leave you and you can call, you know, one of the other agencies that'll, you know, charge you thousands of dollars to pull your boat off of the ground. So make the choice. Would you like this little lady to help you? Or would you like to sit on the sandbar for another couple of hours and wait for high tide or pay a lot of money? You choose. And usually they change their attitude a little bit. I worked with Coast Guard fairly often. So you know, like the added potential scrutiny of the, you know, like the Coast Guard guys when we would have cases together would always make me a little bit nervous. But over time, especially when I was like a staff member for the search and rescue team, I had not built up a crazy reputation, but I'd worked with enough of the guys often enough that like, oh, it's you. Oh, she knows exactly what she's doing. Yeah, she's fine. No, don't tell her what to do. She knows what she's going to do. It's everything's going to be okay. So it was nice to develop those relationships over time and have people recognize that like even a woman can drive a boat in an emergency, which is sad that you have to convince people of that. But you know.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. I have never really understood why sort of boating is still kind of like a macho manly thing. Like it doesn't really make any sense to me.
Yeah, agreed. A fisherman that I worked with when I was doing my grad work was in a lobster fishery for years. And I was just super excited and impressed when I started working with him that his daughter was running his other boat. So the two of them were captains, and you know, like depending on what season it was, like his daughter just, you know, like was a lot of times she would be pulling their stone crab traps while he was working with lobster traps. And then, you know, as needed, she would fill in on the lobster side. But it was just really nice to see a woman commanding the respect of, you know, an all male crew, not getting any crap for it from them. And, you know, kind of the captain didn't need a son to take over the business. He had his daughter who was going to come in and take over for him eventually when he retired. So,
yeah. So you mentioned working in the Keys, and I think this is probably another good time to talk about kind of your PhD in Miami in the Keys. What made you decide to go to the University of Miami to get your PhD?
After I graduated from Eckerd, I spent a couple of years working as a staff member for the search and rescue team. And as much as I loved it, the excitement, the, you know, like first responder, always jumping into action, I missed science, and I knew that I really wanted to get back into science. I connected back with some of my Eckerd professors to get advice about getting into graduate school and started looking for fisheries programs. So during my time as a staff member with the search and rescue team, I was, you know, like reading up to try to figure out what do I want to go to graduate school for? I don't want to just go. And I read the book Cod, and for some reason it really resonated with me. Fisheries weren't a huge part of the curriculum at Eckerd. So, you know, I took a lot of classes that were related to ecology, and there wasn't really a fisheries focus at all when I was in undergrad. And it was kind of eye-opening for me because I really liked the applied nature of fisheries work. I really liked that I could do work that would potentially impact the community. So I think going along the lines of the search and rescue work that I did, where I was being involved in the community, I also liked the idea of having a career where the work that I would do might impact people more directly. So I was looking for fisheries programs. The Rosenstiel School at University of Miami was, in my mind, a top program. So I was applying there, Duke, Stanford. So I was looking for people who were doing interesting research in the fisheries field. And I knew that there were a lot of scientists that I could potentially work with at the University of Miami. Out of the schools that were recruiting me, they were my top pick. So, you know, being offered an assistantship where I could focus fully on my dissertation work was definitely a big draw. So that helped bring me to Miami. Even though I applied to some schools outside of Florida, I did really like the idea of staying in Florida and then having a program where fisheries could be a big focus for me, but also not fully understanding the graduate school process when I got in or the challenge that was ahead of me. But luckily, I figured it out in time.
So you ended up researching lionfish, which are invasive to the North Atlantic and have become kind of a pretty big nuisance throughout the Caribbean and you know, southern North Atlantic. Can you tell me a little bit more about that research?
Sure. So when I started at UM, I didn't have a master's degree. I was, you know, essentially coming straight from undergrad, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, really ecologically focused in terms of my undergrad work. And then I started taking all these fisheries courses. So I was trying to readjust and think, you know, like what questions do I want to answer? I was lucky in some ways that my advisor was pretty open-minded. He said that, you know, like I could frame my question, like whatever my dissertation work would be, in whatever way I want. So I wasn't joining a lab where I would have to do a project on tuna or billfish or something specific, that I had a little bit of leeway in terms of some of the questions that I could answer. And I had to take at least a couple of years to take fisheries courses to get more prepared to actually be able to answer those questions and to have a strong kind of statistical basis for the work that I was doing. So in that time, lionfish were in the news more and more as becoming a bigger issue. They had reinvaded Florida via the Florida Keys. I listened to a lot of talks from Lad Atkins and people at Reef about the problem that was happening with lionfish and thought, huh, this could be an interesting way to take fisheries principles and apply them to a invasive fish species instead of some of the native fish species that we're working with. So most of the people in my lab were using like fisheries landings data to look at questions related to billfishes, but I took a completely like left turn looking at the invasive lionfish problem and thinking about lionfish kind of from a fisheries perspective. So I tried to do maybe a little too much with my dissertation work because you always start going down those rabbit holes of maybe this, or what about this? So I started out first just trying to understand more about lionfish dynamics in terms of their life history. So there had been a lot of discussion of lionfish reproducing a crazy amount, reproducing year round. And I wanted to see if we could validate that in what lionfish were being caught and found in like year round. So just because lionfish have the potential to spawn year round, do we actually have lionfish recruiting to the Caribbean reefs or Florida reefs throughout the year? So I worked with some folks up in North Carolina to get a set of juvenile lionfish otoliths and use that to investigate whether or not you could see lionfish that were aged back to their birthday if they were born throughout the calendar year. Basically just, you know, was able to verify that lionfish were actually spawning and having their larvae survive and recruit to Bahamian reefs throughout the year. And then I used some of that information and literature information related to scorpionids to help parameterize a biophysical model. So I worked with Claire Paris to try to recreate the lionfish spread using her connectivity modeling system to try to investigate the connections between lionfish sources and sinks. So using the reef sightings database, I sent out virtual lionfish-like particles and tracked their spread. So using the current information that we had from the time that those sightings first happened, and then allowing for kind of year-round spawning or year-round particles to be sent in the water column. I used it to try to recreate the spread and then look to see how, you know, like with the Gulf Stream, there should be and is this big break between Florida and the Bahamas or Florida and the rest of the Caribbean in terms of the like the genetic structure of a lot of fish species, but lionfish were able to bridge or break that divide. So trying to look at those connections more closely to better understand how and why lionfish spread so quickly. I continued on looking at more of like an applied question of now that lionfish are reinvading Florida, they're starting to show up in habitats where we hadn't seen them before. So the lobster fishery in the Florida Keys in large part is focused in kind of shallower nearshore habitats. But I worked with a lobster fisherman who was setting his pots in deeper water. So 75 feet of water and greater, he was starting to see a lot of lionfish's bycatch in his lobster traps. So he was using wire traps offshore. A lot of the inshore people use wooden traps. And he was just seeing these like large number of lionfish popping up in his traps. So I spent a couple of years kind of working as an observer on his lobster boat, cataloging his catch and looking at the catch composition and the proportion of traps where lionfish were present. And then over time, it looked like there was kind of a dynamic where if you had a lot of lionfish, you'd have very few lobster and vice versa. So the last chapter of my dissertation was a tank experiment where I tried to investigate that relationship further. So was it just a matter of where the traps were set and being closer to lobster habitat or lionfish habitat, or was there some sort of antagonism between the two species. So I put lionfish and lobsters together in a tank and look to see how they would spend their time over the course of the day. So it looked like the lobsters were able to kind of prevent the lionfish from establishing themselves or spending a lot of time in some of the different habitats that I had available in the tank. When I was working on that last bit, my advisor said, all right, so we need to stop looking at more questions and wrap this up. So, okay, good call. I could keep researching and looking at things forever, but I tried to tie all those kind of like disparate parts together to look at the lionfish invasion from the impact of this invasive species spreading throughout the Caribbean and trying to understand how and why it was able to, they were able to spread as quickly as they did. And then also looking at the local impact of lionfish in the Florida Keys, particularly them showing up in these deeper water habitats that were not as close to the more available natural reef habitat, the patch reefs closer to shore, and trying to understand how that fishery might be a way to try and bring down lionfish numbers. And then also thinking about why lionfish and lobsters were having this antagonistic behavior in the traps, and thinking that, you know, like in the shallower habitat, the reef offers a lot better habitat for lionfish than these deeper offshore areas where the traps essentially form the structure that lionfish might find as they're going between reef habitats. So pulling all that together to think about lionfish and their journey to becoming established in the Florida Keys.
That is massive.
Maybe a little bit too much.
That's incredible. So one of the things that you said about lionfish becoming reestablished, like I always thought that there was a single introduction. That's what I was always told about the lionfish story.
So I think that question is undetermined. So there was an article that said during Hurricane Andrew, there was a fish tank on a seawall in Miami and 6 lionfish were introduced at that point, and that could have been the start of the invasion. Later, that article was retracted and said that that never happened. But, you know, Florida is a hotspot for exotic species. We know that lionfish have been imported to Florida for years. We also know that there have been marine parks in Florida and the Bahamas that have had lionfish in tanks for years. So there are accounts both in the Bahamas and in Florida of lionfish being seen in reef habitat as early as the 80s. So I think just a lot of, you know, like random introductions of lionfish, a population, a breeding population of lionfish finally established itself. And then it led to the invasion that we see now. So all signs point to lionfish starting in either Florida or the Bahamas, and then spreading to the rest of the Caribbean. And then back in 2009 and 2010, lionfish had been seen all along the like eastern seaboard, but they really hadn't been seen in the Florida Keys. So when I'm talking about being reestablished, it's when they were first introduced to the Florida Keys or first starting to be seen regularly in the Florida Keys, which was happening in 2009 and 2010.
I think that's when they started to travel up the West Coast too. I'm trying to remember that.
Exactly.
There were actually trawl surveys that were able to capture lionfish invasion as it happened.
Right.
Like they would, I think CMAP got like one or two way down south one year. And then the next year they got some a little bit further north and then like a little bit further north. And then all of a sudden they were like all the way in Alabama.
Yeah, I think so. The fisherman that I worked with in the Keys, he started out in his first year and he had 13 lionfish that he caught in his traps over the course of the lobster season. The next year it was hundreds of lionfish, and the next year it was thousands of lionfish. So in a really short period of time, he went from first seeing a couple of lionfish to then, you know, essentially being able to create a mini market for himself by selling his lionfish catch to local restaurants. So,
and they are really tasty.
They're delicious. One of the best things ever is being able to get your own lionfish. And there was a restaurant in the Middle Keys called Lazy Days that I would potentially stop at with my fresh lionfish catch, and then they would deep fry them whole for you. So they'd bring the lionfish out on a platter with the pectoral fins kind of splayed out beautifully. So the presentation is amazing. So the captain I worked with would talk about how when he was first trying to sell lionfish to restaurants, he went to some of the local restaurants with a cooler, opened it up, and then, you know, like people would be like, oh, what's that fish? And they would sell out that day. So he definitely made kind of a production out of it to try to get people interested in buying lionfish. And then it was really easy for them to get bought out over the course of a night as soon as someone saw the like really beautiful presentation. And then luckily they're a delicious fish. So it's a win-win for everybody.
Your current position is in the Fishery Dependent Monitoring Program. What keeps you going in Fishery Dependent Monitoring? What do you like the best about the work that you do right now?
As I continue on in life, so much of what I do in the future is based on kind of my interactions from the past. Working on this lobster boat for a couple of years, talking to a fisherman who'd been a part of the lobster fishery for the better part of 40 years when I first met him. He started as a teenager going down with a couple of traps. Him and his then girlfriend, now wife, would put traps out on the weekends, and it's how he afforded to put himself and her through college. And then, you know, like continued to build from like a tiny, not John boat, but like a pretty small boat to a bigger operation, and now having a two boat fleet. He would tell me all these stories about how things had changed in the Keys over time, how the lobster fishery had changed, how the reef fish community had changed. And I was just super intrigued by this information that I was getting about the fishery. And, you know, I'm taking all these courses during graduate school where we're talking about the data that we collect and trying to make sure that we're very careful about the data and thinking about, you know, like getting data from fisheries independent sources being kind of the gold standard so that you can really answer questions because you have a lot less potential bias and kind of nuisance variables that you're dealing with in terms of the data that you collect. Learning from this person and getting so much kind of background history while I was working with him, I thought was really valuable. So I love that part of what I do is continuing to work with stakeholders and continuing to utilize data that comes directly from the fishery, because it does show, you know, at least the exploitation factor that are impacting the fisheries that we're trying to manage and keep sustained for years to come. You know, we get all this data in, and I can look at trends and data and see that there is, you know, like this crazy peak in 2012 or a big decline in 2014. And, you know, like it's a number, but I don't necessarily have a reference for how or why that number exists, but the stakeholders do. So I like working with the fishermen and getting to hear their perspective and listen to them about what they see out on the water, because they are out there every day, and it can help provide context for the information that we're getting and the data that we're collecting. So I'd say what I value most about my job is, one, getting to do applied work where I see pretty directly how the work I do can impact the community. So, you know, like having our group help provide data to fisheries managers that allows them to set the quota or the season length for red snapper in the Gulf of Mexico, or helping participate in a specialized survey on the east coast of Florida that helps to estimate the amount of fish that are landed during the really small pulse fishery for red snapper on the east coast of Florida. Just trying to create an effort survey that helps to better estimate reef fish landings in Florida, I think is really valuable. So just, I like the applied nature of the work that we do. And I like that we're taking stakeholder information into consideration and making sure that we are helping to bridge the gap between the science community and the stakeholders, so that the stakeholders understand how and why the science is happening. And then also we can make sure that, you know, like the fishery scientists who are looking at ones and zeros understand how and why those ones and zeros came to be by giving them additional information that we get from the stakeholder side. I'm glad that I don't have to be the fisheries manager who's making the final decision on when a fishery is going to be open or closed. You know, you have a lot of scientific information, but you have to weigh that against kind of the economics related to keeping, you know, like the Florida economy going. There are a lot of jobs and livelihoods that are impacted by the different fisheries decisions that are made. You know, people are, you know, like rightfully very worried about making sure that they can continue to make a living. And then from the science side, we're doing the best job that we can to paint an accurate picture of what's happening in these fisheries. So the marriage between the two of, you know, like providing information to provide a clear picture of what's happening in the fishery, which is so difficult to do. And then also weighing that against kind of the needs to provide opportunities for people to access our resources is really difficult. There's a lot of transparency in the fisheries management process. You know, as much as I learned about fisheries dynamics in graduate school, we didn't necessarily talk about the full stock assessment process from the point of view of how the public and the stakeholders get to weigh in, and they have an avenue to do that. So either through the CDAR process while stock assessments are happening, or through the council process where as decisions are being made in the management, there's also a discussion of what does the public think about these things and people getting to weigh in and have their thoughts be known. Learning more and more about how species are being highlighted for review in part based on stakeholders saying, hey, I see that there's this potential problem in this fishery. I'm catching less and less of this species. Is there something that you can do about it? Can you tell me or have your scientists look into this species more, even if it's not the next species to be assessed? So at least people have a platform where they can, you know, speak to what they see is going on and have it considered by the scientists.
Yeah, that's true. And you know, your point about how sometimes we look further into a fishery when the people on the water are noticing that there might be a decline.
Definitely. I mean, they're generally the people who are out there on the front lines seeing what happens. And, you know, like for me, as much as I love fish, I'm not a great fisherman. When I lived in Miami, I had a friend in the Keys who would take me out on the water fairly often, but I was better at tying the knots to keep the hook on the line than actually catching the fish. So I can understand the dynamics of what's going on in a fishery, and I can read up on the life history to learn more, but I don't have kind of the gut knowledge of being a fisherman who's out there that can see the change happening in the moment. And because I'm not a fisherman, I think in a lot of ways I'm not like, I need that fisherman perspective to help tune me to what potential issues could be and to point me in the right direction when I'm looking over data to better understand the trends. I can, you know, like work really hard to do a good job to help make sure that the data that goes into our different fishery stock assessment models is as clean as possible and provides as much context as possible.
So one of the things that I also always like to do is acknowledge that we are, in addition to being, you know, scientists, we're also people in the world and not just science robots. And, you know, sometimes even when we go out and have a beer or whatever, we sound like science robots. But what are some of the activities that you enjoy outside of science and work?
So beer is definitely one. Since the time when I left St. Pete to go to Miami for grad school and came back, the downtown area has become chock full of breweries. So since I've gotten back, I've definitely worked my way through them to figure out where my favorite breweries are. So I enjoy beer, especially during the pandemic. I try to support the local breweries as much as possible so that they're still here when it's safe for us to all be out and about. I've also been doing quite a bit of gardening in the last year and just some general home projects. So I built a little garden box in my backyard and I've been trying to grow things like tomatoes and lettuce and trying to figure out what my summer / fall crops will be so I can continue to provide myself with a little bit more food. And then actually getting out in nature. So I've also spent a lot of the last year camping and getting in and around Florida, trying to really enjoy the outdoors. So, you know, like I took a canoe trip down to the Everglades around Christmas time. I've spent a couple of weekends at Myakka State Park. I usually do a trip to the east coast of Florida every year and camp kind of close to New Smyrna Beach. So I've been trying to stay sane by staying out in nature, enjoying my home and making it a little bit more fun and comfortable to be in. And then, you know, you need a beer while you're doing house projects. So I get growlers and crowlers from the local breweries to keep me going.
So if you were hanging out, drinking a little bit of beer from one of those crawlers, and you were about to start a story with, no shit, there I was, how would that story go?
Oh man, that's a hard one. I feel like I have a lot of boat stories. So when I'm around my Eckerd friends, it's usually this, you know, like an Eckerd College Church and Rescue story of, oh man, there was this one crazy time. So I'll tell you a story from that. And then right after I graduated from Eckerd, I took a job as the staff instructor. So essentially being paid to help train the new search and rescue people as they're coming up. So the summer after I graduated, I was transitioning into a role where I was the SAR coordinator, the person who, you know, is behind the scenes, making sure that the boat is doing the right things and making the right decisions. So the head of the waterfront at the time was a woman named Jen DeMick. And she was training me by giving me more freedom while I was out on the boat to make decisions and then check in with her afterwards. It was in the middle of the summer, a summer storm popped up, and we had gotten a call that there was a sailboat that had been demasted up in the bay. So we started heading that way. Then someone else picked those people up, so they were fine. And then we heard another call of a boat that was getting too close to a bridge leading out to the beach. So we're going towards that case. And then that got canceled. And then we had a third case because, you know, these summer storms pop up and the winds pick up really quickly. I think there was a tropical storm maybe that was a couple of days out. And it was just, you know, like heavy winds leading up to that. And this boat had broken, like it was anchored. The boat was disabled. They couldn't make it back into the boat ramp. And the guy's anchor was dragging. He was getting closer and closer to like crashing into a seawall. So we're on our way from kind of a northern part in the bay to get to this guy. So he was kind of on our way home. So I'm like, all right, perfect. This will be easy. All we have to do is, you know, take this guy under tow, take him to a boat ramp. Everything's fine. So when I pull up to the boat, I was, you know, going through this channel that was protected from the wind and the channel was really flat and calm. And I'm like, I bet this boat is going to be right on the edge of where this shoal protects me. And of course, I leave this little protected area and the seas are starting to pick up because of all the wind and I'm no longer blocked by the shoal. And the boat is kind of not wedged, but like there was a piece of a dock floating really close to the boat so I couldn't come next to it. On the side away from the seawall, it was too close to the seawall for me to come in on the side closest to the seawall. So I was trying to figure out how I'd be able to approach this boat to, one, get one of our people on the boat, because we would normally put one of our people on the boat to attach lines, get the captain to sign paperwork and make sure that they understood kind of the liability associated with us taking their boat under tow or helping them out. And I just couldn't get very close. So I'm like, all right, guys, we're just going to anchor. We're going to back down really close to them. And I'm going to have somebody swim from our boat to their boat. So I call in, I say, oh, they'll be like wind is 25 miles an hour. The sea conditions, it's about 2 to 3 feet. One of my crew members goes and takes our tow line. They have a tow set up ready to go. They tie a big bowline in the end. So a big loop in the end of the line, put it around their shoulders and like, all right, I'm going to jump in. And I said, no, that's not how we do things. So they had a rescue line pack on. So if they got in trouble, I could pull them back into the boat. And then they swam with the tow line over to the boat. And the gentleman who was on the boat pulled them out of the water and into the boat. So while we're doing all this, we've got our little red and yellow flashing lights going. And I see kind of a crowd building up on the seawall watching us. I'm like, well, this is fun. We've got all these people watching, so I better not mess up. Everything went pretty easily. We got the boat under tow. I was like, my engines were over the anchor line of the boat that we were going to tow. So I couldn't turn my boat on to have us to drive away initially. So I had one of my crew pulling the anchor rope. So they're pulling our boat and the boat that we were towing until I could get far enough away from this person's anchor line to start driving and take them away. So in my mind, it was, you know, like a little bit challenging because there was, you know, this dock in the way. I couldn't easily get alongside the boat. I had to put somebody in the water, which we don't love to do. We did it safely. We go back, in my mind, just pretty easy, not too crazy, a little bit of a challenge, but nothing too insane. I go into the office the next day and my boss said, oh, you know, how did that case go? Oh yeah, you know, it was pretty easy. It was a little bit challenging for this reason, but overall, not too bad. And she's like, so how big were the seas? I'm like, oh, you know, like 2 feet, 3 feet. And she's like, oh, really? So she turns her computer screen around. Someone on the seawall had been taking pictures. And I guess my estimation of sea conditions was not great. The waves were at least like 4 to 5 feet. So you see the person swimming and this crazy wave and the arm of the person reaching over the side of the boat to pull our person out of the water. And she said, well, those seas were more like 4 to 5 feet. Like everything went fine. But I always think about this like crazy situation where I thought the case went really well and it did overall. But the point of view from like the seawall looking at what was happening was that I put this small woman in the water in crazy high seas to do this intense rescue of this boat that was disabled when, you know, like it was a lot more simple than that. But it's one of those crazy times that I think about just because the pictures from it were kind of insane in terms of the sea state that we were working in, but everything went pretty well.
When you're trained and you know what you're doing, it's not quite as crazy as what people might observe from the outside.
Oh yeah. And then the person that I put in the water, she'll talk about it later. Like, oh yeah, that time that you let me swim to the boat in crazy seas. And I'm like, you volunteered, you wanted to do it. It was fine. You were the strongest swimmer on the boat. Everything was great. For me, it's pretty memorable because it was one of the first times that I had to do that. It went pretty well, but it was fun to have kind of an outsider's perspective of how that decision went and not even realize it because I had no idea that there was a photographer out on the seawall when it was happening. And I guess this is someone who's seen us do rescues in the past and maybe lives on or close to the water. So periodically he'd see us in the middle of a rescue and take these really cool pictures and send them on. So
now the tough part of the interview is over and it's down to my final three questions. We always like to start off really simple here on the podcast with what is your favorite fish?
Favorite fish? That's really hard. I don't know that I have a favorite fish, which is horrible. It's definitely not lionfish. My favorite ocean creature is a giant squid. So I'd say that. So I'm breaking your rules, but that's my favorite ocean animal. And if I had to pick a fish, I guess I'd go with a blue shark because I like how awkward they are.
Awkward?
Yeah, I feel like their pectoral fins are like really skinny and I think they look a little bit awkward. They're like their bodies, I think, are a little bit like skinny and torpedo-like. They just, to me, they seem a little bit awkward.
What is your dream job or location?
Generally, I enjoy my job. I think about in the future, what would I want to be doing? And probably something similar to what I'm doing now, but possibly working with students more. So I've taught a bit and I don't necessarily want to be a college professor full time, but I'd really love to incorporate working with students more into my day-to-day job responsibilities. So whether that means like being on the committees for graduate students more often to just stay more in touch with the research side of things while also getting to be a part of the applied work that I do for the state where I feel like I have a direct line into providing data that can impact what's going on with fisheries management in Florida. I think if I could add a component where I was working with more students as well, that would kind of be a perfect marriage of a lot of the things that I like to do. So working with students, working with stakeholders, and trying to provide high quality data.
And our final question, if there was one point or principle you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
For fisheries folks to figure out a way to explain what you do in terms that the general public can understand. So the principle I want people to consider is, you know, like science communication, learning how to communicate the work that you do well so that people around you can understand the kind of decisions that you're making, the research that you're doing, and why it's important. Because everything from, especially working from the government side, so much of the hard work that we do can be completely lost if we can't translate and make people understand how or why the work that we do is important. So learning how to communicate your science to the people around you is so key. My family definitely helped to encourage me in the field that I've taken, but they aren't necessarily science folks. So, you know, like being able to connect with them about what I do and why I think it's so important, why I wanted to go to grad school and like swim with sharks a bit and be out on lobster boats and why I love nature, to be able to explain what you do and why it matters, I think is really important. And that's really how we'll be able to make positive change and continue to connect with stakeholders, is being able to communicate well with them so they understand how and why we're doing what we do to preserve the resources or conserve the resources to make things more sustainable. You know, you have to be able to explain what those fisheries dynamics principles are in a way that people can digest them, so they're going to have buy-in and, you know, get on board with the different management decisions that are being made.
Thanks again for chatting with me and coming on the show. If people wanted to get in touch with you online, where could they find you?
Probably the best thing to do would be to connect with me on LinkedIn in terms of like finding me professionally, or just calling the Florida Fish and Wildlife and asking for me, and I can connect with you there.
Thanks to everyone for listening to this 116th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. If you'd like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at @FishVecchio. The podcast is at Fisheries Pod. We're on Facebook and Instagram at Fisheries Podcast, or old-fashioned email feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app, or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. And don't forget to head on over to our Patreon page and support the podcast if you feel inclined. I'm Julie Vecchio. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, make sure to translate your science in a way that everyone can understand.
Stats classes. That is important in terms of like, for me, just understanding the data that I'm working with more often.